So let's start with this chart that we started looking at last time. I made a neater copy and included everything else. There's a lot going on here. So this is a map of the mind, or we could say a map of the person, or a map of the world, because all three of those are the same thing in mind-only tradition. And so it's a map, it's a conceptual construction of the mind. So all this is a mere concept, but may be helpful to understand how everything is mere concept by using concepts. So there's these three columns here. This is the sense organ or sensitivity, or in Sanskrit, Indriya, which is like sovereign. You might heard of Indra, the lord of the gods. It's related to, it's like the sovereign, the ruling factor of an experience is the organ, or like sensitivity, receptivity, or faculty, I think is a good word, sense faculty. Maybe better, because organ sometimes we think of like the physical, or like eyeball. It's more like the faculty. Another nice word is door or gate, sense gates. There's these six sense gates, well, five sense gates and a mind gate. And gate's a nice word too, because it's where stuff enters. The experience of the world enters through these gates. Eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, which is more complicated, the mind organ we'll get into. But then, and then we have over on the other right-hand column, the object, or Vishaya in Sanskrit, object or field of experience. Field is like the... So it's like a faculty is relating to the field. And so there we have, you know, color. Usually with form, sometimes they say eye and form. But form and color are almost the same thing, but also for vision, there's shape is an object of vision of an eye. So sound, smells, tastes are like tactile object, or you know, touch is like tactile objects. And then, and this is where it gets strange down here at the bottom too, we'll get into, is in the earlier systems, it's mental objects, are the mind objects, but in this mind-only school, this storehouse consciousness is the field or object of experience. And then what connects those two, what connects the faculty and the object, are the consciousnesses. So one for each, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind or mental consciousness. And so Buddha actually taught in the earliest sutras, in the Pali Canon, these basically six, six, and six. He didn't call it storehouse consciousness at this point, but that's the main difference. Otherwise, there's six sense faculties, six faculties. You know, mental isn't exactly a sense. Well, maybe we could say the mind sense, loosely. So kind of six sense faculties, six objects, and six consciousnesses, which are called the 18 realms, 18 dhatus, in Buddha's early teaching. So this mind-only system, and also in the Buddha's early teaching, he says some interesting things that are quite in accord with mind-only. Like at one point he says something like, "What is the world?" I can't remember exactly how, in this one of these early sutras, he says, "What is the world?" And he says, it's these 18 dhatus, which is kind of like a mind-only statement. What is the world? Well, it's all these 18 consciousnesses. And so even in the early system, it's like, well, the world is like, you know, what about all the, like, objects of experience? Well, that's, this is the what we might call the objective world. And in early Buddhism, it might be like, these aren't necessarily mind, right? These are objects. And the last one in the early system is called the dharmas, or phenomena, mental phenomena. So the dharma dhatu. And so this mind-only school now plays with this a little bit down in the mind department at the bottom here. So we have the same six consciousnesses, and then this system adds in a seventh and an eighth. In the Yogacara or mind-only tradition, there's eight consciousnesses. So to start with the seventh, how about? Well, maybe a little bit, just talk about the six, because this would be the same in the early system in mind-only. I wrote here, it's called mano vijñana. Vijñana is consciousness. And it's, as I talked about last week,
mano
vijñana. The vi, like in English, in Sanskrit, vi means like to divide. It's like what makes the jnana, which is like a non-dual awareness, makes it dualistic. Vijñana is like dualistic knowing. So it could be quite subtly dualistic, but it's inherently, experiences things in terms of subject and object. That's what we mean by dualistic. And so it's like a subject that experiences an object separate from it. So it's, here's our, you know, different translations. Instead of consciousness, we could call it awareness, cognition, discernment, and discrimination. The dis words are maybe kind of similar to the vi of vijñana. It's like discriminating and discerning between different things. So these words might sound kind of different, but these are all ways that this word vijñana gets translated into English. So now we have the mind organ. And so you might say, well, why do we need that? And we started to get into that last time. People were asking, well, what's the difference between mind consciousness and a mind organ? Well, in a way, not so much, especially in the early system. I think part of the reason for this is it's to complete the system, to complete the map. You're going down here, and we say, well, you know, there should be a mental consciousness. It's kind of maybe first you fill in the center column, and like, well, you get to the five senses, but then there's also something else happening. We have to account for this as a mental consciousness. So then to complete the system, well, what does mental consciousness have as an object? Well, we say phenomena in the early system. Okay, so now we need something over here. So, oh, we need a faculty or an organ or a gate. So they call it manas or mano dhatu. It's maybe called in the early system also. So sometimes translated as intellect or thought or mentation or the thinker that thinks, right? It's like the kind of thing that does the consciousness. And so it's not actually it's quite different from these. You know, obviously a tongue is different from a tongue consciousness, but this is where it gets kind of like, well, what's the difference there? So they do this interesting thing that I hesitate to get into much, but just, you might have heard this before, and if it sounds really strange, then maybe we can talk about it later, but I don't think we need to spend too much time on it. But just the way this is defined in the early system and mind only is what is this mental faculty? It's the just deceased consciousness, just deceased previous consciousness. So that sounds really weird, I know. But the idea you need a kind of like a dominant condition. Like these are called the dominant conditions for this experience. So for a visual experience, you need like an object condition. It's called the object here. You need a dominant condition, which is the faculty. And you also need like an immediately antecedent condition. You need like the condition. One of the conditions for an experience is the previous moment. In every case, that's what this means. So that a previous moment of experience has to cease in order for this moment of experience to arise. So that might sound like obvious, but it's one of the conditions for an experience, is the immediately preceding experience. So what's done here, let me just finish this story, is that you need a dominant condition for mental consciousness. And well, there's no like mind organ. We don't say like the brain. These are not physical things here. So the mind organ is the just previously deceased, previously ceased moment of consciousness gets put into the category of the mental faculty. Again, I hesitate to get into this more because it's a very weird thing, and I've spent hours contemplating myself, like why this was done and how this makes sense. But if you want to, we could talk about it more, but maybe we could come back to it or something. Kathy had a question.
Well, actually, for me, just thinking of it as the faculty which produces the consciousness, that works for me.
Yeah.
I mean, you can get all, like, you know, pulling apart and deconstruct what that faculty is. Mm-hmm. You can look at prior experience,
yeah,
or you could look at the current thoughts about mind, brain, mm-hmm, brain science. But just thinking of it as the faculty which produces the consciousness, however you define that faculty.
I think that's good.
Is that too simplistic?
I think for our purposes today, that's good. And this thing about the previously deceased consciousness is just answering the question. People will say, well, what is that faculty? What, like, let's look at what it is. But I think you're exactly right that all we need to know is it's the kind of like the dominant condition for an experience, a mental experience. Yeah.
I'm not positive, but I think Immanuel Kant might have called it the condition of the possibility.
Condition of the possibility.
The condition of the possibility is you can have mental consciousness that looks at a storehouse basis is this thing.
Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's ungraspable, like all of it is, actually. Yes?
I think how I've always understood how the mind receives things, if you're saying that, you know, we now have this mind consciousness,
mm-hmm,
that I feel like I've always thought that we can either be dualistic or non-dualistic.
Mm-hmm.
Like there are a lot of increments there,
mm-hmm,
that it receives and does, could be one way, and then it kind of can morph, mm-hmm, into a dualistic, mm-hmm, awareness. Because you're saying that if there's any awareness, it's automatically dualistic. It's automatically.
If it's vijnana, this is why, you know, you can have a non-dual awareness. We wouldn't use the term vijnana. So,
but it wouldn't be listed here.
It's not on this chart. It is, yeah. Of course, the system has to account for this because this is Buddhahood. It's non-dual realization of suchness, for example. But it's not even on this chart. It's off the chart. And I think we will get into this. And well, this is partly the thing that we briefly mentioned last time about the eight consciousnesses are transformed into these four non-dual awarenesses. The vijnanas are transformed into jnanas, like the perfect mirror jnana is what the storehouse consciousness, storehouse vijnana is transformed into at Buddhahood. So there's definitely non-dual experience. But your point reminds me that let's also mention, because we started talking at the very end last time. Jean was asking, I think, about direct experience, and so I wanted to look into this more too. The way I understand it in this system is that five sensory consciousnesses are, we could call, direct perception. There's direct perception of colors and sounds and so on. And we don't have, it's happening all the time for all of us. We're directly perceiving in these, not necessarily all five ways. Like, we might not be having direct taste perception at the moment, but whenever these experiences are happening, we're having direct sensory experiences. So all five of these are always direct. But direct perception does not mean non-dual, interestingly. I think they're very subtly dualistic because they're consciousnesses. And we could say the way in which they're dualistic, which is actually what this whole school is getting into, is that even in the, according to this model, even in direct sensory perception, there's a very subtle projection of subject-object separation that we're not even conscious of. That an eye faculty seeing a color, there's still this very slight, as I understand what they're saying here, very slight sense, imperceptible sense that the color is separate from the eye, that they're two different, that they're not just all one mind. So I think this is how this gets resolved. We can have direct perception that's still very subtly dualistic, and that therefore it's a vijnana. And then when we get into mental consciousness, it can be direct. You can actually, there can be direct mental perception. And this would be like the moment after a direct sensory experience. So we see black, and then the next moment, and a moment's like a lot less than a second, right? Just momentarily after, or maybe we could even say the same. It sounds like, according to this sutra that we'll get into in this chapter, it sounds like they're like it says the same time, it sounds like. Whether it's the same time or just, you know, a moment after, there's a direct mental perception. Non-conceptual. Again, so non-conceptual and non-dual are two different things. Slightly different things. We're using these words. So it's non-conceptual because it's direct experience, mental experience of black. So we have the black, and then the mind faculty knows it as black before it becomes conceptual, and then immediately afterwards, you know, we can't pull these things apart in our experience. But this is the proposal of the system, is that and then conceptual consciousness, which is another moment of mental consciousness, then labels it, oh, I see a black, and it's a cushion, and it's too soft or too hard or whatever, all the things that we, the mental consciousness then becomes totally conceptual. So these are all direct perception, non-conceptual direct perception, but subtly dualistic. This can have a moment of direct mental perception, non-conceptual, but still subtly dualistic. And then there's indirect perception, we could also call conception. It becomes conceptual, and that's the usual mental consciousness that we know and love is the conceptual one. And also there are what's called yogic direct perception. So we might say, well, what if you're meditating really deeply and you have a direct mental perception of, say, impermanence or emptiness, even, there can be such a thing, a according to the system, you can have a direct mental perception of emptiness. And as I understand it, that is not the end of the story. It's still, even though that's an incredibly wonderful thing and necessary on the path, it's not conceptual even, right? But it's still this subtly dualistic split of emptiness and the mind that's perceiving it, slightly separated. So chapter 8 of the sutra that we won't even get into in this class gets into some of these things. When it's also the differences between shamatha and vipassana are around this point, that in terms of like a story about meditation here, we could tell about zazen, say, is that you could have, well, first let's take, we call some of these terms we used in Rohatsu Sashin for people who are here. There's shamatha with support. Shamatha means calm abiding when you're meditating in stillness. And with support means like an object. These could also be called supports.
What you're called?
The objects or fields could be called support. So they support the consciousness. In fact, you need that support for the consciousness to happen. All three arise together. So these arrows here mean like this consciousness kind of mediates between the field and the faculty. So calm abiding with support would be like with the breath. So you take an object, and the breath, I would say, is like here. It's the touch. It's the body. It's a bodily object. Sounds strange to call breath touch, but I think that's where it fits, right? It's a physical sensation that you're attending to. Sometimes we even say just attend to the posture. And the Buddha talked about like mindfulness of the body and mindfulness of the breath. He has a sutra on each of them in the Pali Canon that are very similar. There are two different, slightly different, breath is part of the body, but you could say the posture and the breath. This is in Zazen instruction. We say focus on that physical object. So you can have it, well, we're having a direct experience, but in meditation, actually, we're actually cultivating, we're using the mental consciousness, actually, to follow a kind of an image of the breath. You can't meditate with the first five, really. You say, well, what about if you're just listening to sounds as without any, you know, just hearing a sound without any thinking going on? Still, the way I would understand this system is you're using the sound along with the mental consciousness that's almost like a, you could say, you could get down to the point where it's a direct perception, direct mental perception of the sound, in addition, of course, to the direct sensory perception of sound. But there's always this, in meditation, if we're talking about the whole picture of a zazen, there's always going to be this mental consciousness operating with the same object, as the sutra will say. Like there's the actual breath that, you know, direct experience of the breath that we have no access to. It's happening all the time, but like we have no idea. We'll never have any idea about that. The only way we can actually follow it is to use the mental consciousness. But you could get to the point where, calm abiding with an object would be like you're using this, and calm abiding without an object, objectless, or without support, they usually say. But same thing, without an object. Objectless, I think we could say here. I mean, again, you could talk about objectless as non-dual in this other kind of sense, but let's just say without support means like you don't even use like sounds or a body, but you just, I think this is sometimes how people think of shikantaza, that you're just not attending to any particular object, you're just letting go of all conceptual thought of past and future, just resting the mind in itself. And the way that that's talked about is like the mental consciousness gets, is like, as the sutra will say, in a, as we get to it. It's kind of like waves on the ocean of the storehouse consciousness. And then if it would be like this calm abiding without support, it's like you're just like resting the waves more and more, so the waves get more and more still, and they kind of sink back into the storehouse consciousness. So, and then you're just resting in the clarity aspect, the clear, aware aspect of the sixth and eighth consciousness, the clear awareness aspect of consciousness and the storehouse. And that's not the whole story. Even though, again, it sounds pretty good, that's just like, this is a storehouse of delusion. Basically a storehouse of dualistic, grossly and subtly dualistic mind, which is inherently painful, even though the pain we might have not even perceive it, but it's the root of all our difficulties. So that's why calm abiding without support is different from vipassana. Shamatha without support is pretty great practice. It's like you're just letting go of all thought, you're resting in the present, but it's still just calm abiding. It doesn't have the insight yet, so that's what the system's developing, this whole story around non-dual meditation where there's no separation at all.
I would have thought that seven, the pramanas, was the source of the dualistic delusion, not eight.
Oh, okay, so that's the one we haven't talked about yet, is eight. First let's finish seven. So it's the mind, intellect, mentation. But in this system, in Yogacara now, it's going to get this thing added to it called klishta, which is related to klesha, which means affliction. So it becomes the afflicted mind, the klishta manas, and it's afflicted by view of self of the person. So that's partly what they do here, is it almost like the seven consciousness becomes like the sense of a personal self, of me. And then we can say more about that too. There's more about, that's an interesting thing they did there. It's the sense of a self. And actually, because it's like the I thought, the I creator, the me creator, is aware of, is conscious of, this is the object. So it's usually said that this mind faculty, afflicted by this false view of an independent self, thinks that the storehouse consciousness is the self of the person.
And
the stuff in it is separate, and that it's all me. And in fact, it's, if we have to say, and they actually say in the system, the conventional self, in all different Buddhist systems, there's the delusion. Ultimately, the ultimate truth is that there's no abiding self. There's no independent self. But all these systems have the conventional self. So when we look for the self, what does that appear to be? What does our self appear to be? So in the early system, it's like we look for self. We find five skandhas. Form, feeling, perception, formation, consciousness. That's the conventional self. It's not really the self. In this system, the conventional self is actually the storehouse consciousness, which is why it's perceived as like not just a conventional self, but like truly that's who I am. Because it's the repository of everything we've ever done. It's the storehouse of all our activities from our whole life and past lives. So then there's this, so the storehouse, alaya, yes.
It's another word for affliction.
Affliction, defilement, like hindrance, kind of like that. It's afflicted, vexation, it's vexed by, it's...
Spoiled.
tainted,
distorted,
warped, afflicted, yeah. Yeah, kind of like a disease in this case. By this, you know, and of course, it's not really afflicted by that because they're afflicted by the view of a self. But this, you know, it's not something that's really there. So it just appears to be an affliction, and it can be removed. So the Alaya's, the kind of big creative thing of the mind only school, is that it kind of invented this thing called the Alaya Vijnana, the storehouse consciousness, the repository or the basis consciousness, all translations of Alaya, it's the storehouse of all karma means, you know, intentional activities, all the intentional activities of body, speech, and mind that we've ever done are stored, or the moment of that activity, which is constant right now, we're constantly creating karma, even if we don't move, even in zazen, you could say, unless it's completely this primordial wisdom awareness, it's still like creating bits and pieces of little bits of mental karma, which could be neutral. It doesn't have to be wholesome or unwholesome. Just any actions make an imprint in the storehouse. They leave these imprints that are sometimes called seeds, the bija. Sometimes they're called permeations. It's called vasana, which sometimes is translated as perfuming, which is a kind of weird way to say it. But I think it's the idea that there's this invisible permeation, or it's basically the same idea as the seeds, but they're using different kind of metaphors. Or imprints. Maybe vasana is sort of like an imprint.
Also include the extra personnel, like the culture one is born into, and things like that?
Our experience of the culture, I think we'd say, you know, it has to be experienced by the so-called person for it to get planted there. So it's like, yeah, but there's all kinds of like cultural stuff that we experience that we don't even know we experience. It can be like semi-conscious stuff, like you can just the way that that when you're walking down the street, the way you see other people walking down the street and talking to each other is part of the culture, right? And so like that's actually, we're experiencing that and it's getting planted. Now that sounds a little different from karma, and actually, so I think it is not just karmic seeds, but basically it's recording and storing every experience.
It's all possible.
Karma is a big part of it, but that's why I drew all these arrows. You could basically connect 8 to all 18, all 17 other things are actually, and the arrows go two ways. So you have this, you're born, well, you could start from birth, you're born according to the system with this, that's the basis of birth actually, is the storehouse consciousness that it connects with a, like an embryo at a moment of conception is the story. If you don't go for that, at any rate, this is what's giving rise to experience. So, and it already includes a bunch of stuff at birth. And then, and so basically what it includes, even if you don't believe we're carrying karma from past lives, it's storing this, and science might confirm this part of it, it's storing the seeds for an eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. And it's storing seeds for the, because we can see that babies are born with, they're born with all of these faculties, right? Unless they're blind or something. So the story is that actually even the body comes from a seed in Alaya. That this is really the basis of everything. which is why it starts to sound almost like a god or something. And as the sutra says, if you read that verse at the end, I'm careful who I teach this idea to, because they turn it into a big fixed self, or like a creator power, like source of all. And but in fact, it's not anything. It's not something. It's actually, as I understand it, it could even be called what we call dependent co-arising. But the unique container of dependent co-arising for each person. And therefore, at birth, you have this ungraspable, arising and ceasing mass of inconceivable, that's energy soup. In a way, it's like potential energy for giving rise to a body and all these sense faculties and the consciousnesses. All these are developing before birth. And it also, this is where it gets even more radical, it also has the seeds for the objects. In other words, the objects are not like outside, there's this baby developing in the womb, say, and it doesn't really have these objects yet because it's all just like dark and silent, but it has the seeds for them, and as soon as it interacts with what we call the world, it gives rise to these objects. So these objects are like kind of sprout from seeds in the storehouse. That's maybe the weirdest part of this story.
So Plato was the big philosopher in the West, duality, kind of mind and body kind of thing. He spoke of forms, typical forms. So if he were to run into a mind-only Buddhist and be converted, would he put his forms in the storehouse consciousness?
I guess so. Where else could he put them?
Yeah, okay.
That's the thing, is because this is a map of the mind, it's a map of the person, it's also a map of the world. So everything in the world has to fit into one of these 18, and so most of it fits in here. In fact, all of the other 17 fit in here too. They're all emanations. This corner is the basis of all. And also there's seeds. Let me tell a little part of the story more. The seeds that give rise to the faculties and objects are like, they give rise to them both. In this system, they give rise to them both at the same time. In earlier Buddhist systems, there's an object and then the eye meets it. In this system, they're actually not, they're both aspects of the mind, and there's a seed, like it's almost like one seed gives rise to an eye and a color at the same time. How we talk about it, so one seed or two seeds, these are metaphor, the seed thing is a metaphor, but they always arise together. The faculty and the object always arise together as two aspects of one mind. That's why it actually is non-dual. It just appears to be non-dualistic. And so that's why in the end it's going to be seen that there's no separation. So that little point is actually really a radical thing too, that actually colors and eyes and eye consciousness arise simultaneously. It's not like this is even a second before. In earlier systems, this is a second before. Also, there's another really important kind of seed. I mean, there's infinite seeds for everything, but a really crucial seed in the system is this. It's like, maybe you could say, if there's like billions of seeds, like 90% of them or something are like seeds that for dualistic thought, basically believing that this whole thing is separate, believing that the faculties and the they're seeds for experiencing an external world. That's maybe the best way to put it. There's seeds stored from all these experiences from the beginning of evolution for experiencing the mind world as actually separate from the mind. And that's why the whole thing keeps going, because we keep experiencing that, and then we keep planting the seeds, and they sprout. So this is both to contain the repository for all the seeds, and it gives rise to the new thing. So it's continuously giving birth and receiving. It's giving and receiving constantly. It's very, very similar patterns, and that's why we have these really deep habitual patterns, and there's a lot of similarity among sentient beings, that we all sentient beings perceive the world as external to mind. So we have very similar seeds. Yeah.
So let's say, theoretically, there's an awakened Buddha who is reincarnating. Do they, so are there karmic seeds, is there still an alaya vijnana? Like I'm thinking, let's say the Dalai Lama is a realized being who's reincarnating. There's, in this system, what would they say about what's going on in the alaya vijnana of an awakened being? Are there karmic seeds for non-dual perception?
So technically we would say, you know, great bodhisattvas, because a Buddha can't be reborn.
Right.
But like a, you know, these like high stage bodhisattvas can, you know, because of their understanding of this too, they can direct rebirths and so on, according to these stories. But well, the story about this is that the storehouse consciousness continues even after realizing emptiness until Buddhahood. So there's these 10 bodhisattva stages, you know, the bhumis, and I'm pretty sure that this alaya continues up through till the very 10th, and then a Buddhahood, it's transformed into this perfect mirror, primordial awareness. And these stories get completely inconceivable at this point. Also, if we're talking about stages at this point, this one is we have the Mahayana system, which has these 10 bodhisattva stages up to Buddhahood, and we have the original early teachings of kind of like these 4 stages up to arhatship. Arhat is the goal instead of Buddha. So they account for the early system in here too, and they say, I think they say that an arhat alaya ceases also. Vasubandhu's 30 verses say this. Yeah, they actually do say. And one nice thing about this, they say that. The Mahayanas say that. And a nice thing about this Sannyinirmochana Sutra, as a footnote, because we won't get it, it's in chapter 7, but we're just reading a tiny part of chapter 7. It's very, this sutra is very friendly to the so-called lesser vehicles.
Yeah.
Unlike some Mahayana sutras. It actually says that that the Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas must have this same realization. It's just that it's not infused with this great compassion. Mm-hmm. So the insight, they actually say, is the same, at least the insight into mind only. You can read chapter 7 for the details. Anyway, this part is, they say, well, let's say with the small vehicle system, they talk about stream entry, right, is the first realization when you first direct experience that there's no personal self. So that's the time that this klishtamanas, the afflicted mental faculty, gets like all shook up. And in a way, actually, at the moment of direct perception, and some people equate this with what in Zen is called kensho, like a direct experience. Kensho means seeing nature, which means seeing emptiness. But in this case, it's just seeing the emptiness of the personal self. The Mahayana says it's not just about there's no self here, it's that there's no anything anywhere. But at that moment in this early system, at that moment of realization, the klishta part is like not operating. That's the first time that this klishta is not operating. Even when we're in deep sleep, deep samadhi, klishta mana is still going, cooking along. It's like resting, but it's a very subtle sense of like me doing it even if we don't think consciously, like, I'm sitting zazen, is a very subtle sense of a self. It's just like a sense, actually, of a self. In that moment, there's like, the sense drops for like one moment. And so then, say, prior to that, when that stream enter comes out of samadhi, it starts operating again due to the seeds, for which are like, because 90% of the seeds are to keep this thing going, to keep this delusion of a self going. So as soon as that period of zazen is over, wow, that was so cool. I like finally realized the way, and of course, like, I realized it. And that's like, you know, and the sense of it's all back there, yeah. And then they say the story is, I think, at arhatship, it's like it doesn't arise, the klishta part doesn't arise again, there's still a mental organ. And for bodhisattvas, it's the first bodhisattva bhumi, that where the first, to actually enter the bodhisattva path, officially, it's like there's the direct realization of emptiness. And again, this thing is like temporarily knocked down. It's like not operating for like 1 second, 1 moment. But then again, because of these seeds, it continues through all the bodhisattva bhumis up to number 8. These stories get really weird. at the 8th bhumi, the 8th bodhisattva stage, which, you know, I think Nagarjuna was like a second stage bodhisattva, you know. Maybe there haven't been any in the world since the Buddha, right? Mahayana paints a really vast picture of what's possible here, right? At the 8th, and this is, who's coming up with these stories anyway, right? Yeah, right. I think one story is that Asanga, the founder of the school, was like, went to Tushita heaven and got these teachings from Maitreya Buddha. So he was getting it from a Buddha. That's why they're scribes. He was just channeling a Buddha. He didn't, because even Asanga was like a high level bodhisattva, but not enough to talk about the 8th bhumi. Anyway, at the 8th bhumi, it's like, it's, I think it stops, and then it's just called a fruition. Oh no. Yeah, this maybe stops there, but also Alaya at the 8th bhumi ceases to be. Ceases to store up any more karmic seeds, but it's still this, it's called a fruition consciousness. Vasubandhu talks about this too. And it's basically, so there's just a few stages where there's still it's still a consciousness until Buddhahood, where it's transformed into this perfect mirror wisdom. Don't worry about these details. I hesitate to even talk about some of these because we should keep grounded in our practice. It's kind of nice to mention them, I think, for some reasons, just to see that how vast this path is, how far you can take this potentially according to this system. So, did somebody else have a question? Did you have a question? Okay.
But I don't know if I can say it. But it's really, I keep trying to imagine the storehouse consciousness seeds and how they arise. Maybe give rise is better.
Mm-hmm. Give rise.
Moment to moment in this body and mind here. Mm-hmm. And then I was kind of imagining with your question and thinking about bodhisattvas and Buddhahood, it's almost like I'm trying to imagine what arises in this individual in a moment, and there's almost like a loosening of what, of the glue that holds them together, or what each, or how each seed is colored karmically, maybe less and less. It seems like when
less and less because of
in the 7th bhumi.
Oh, okay. Through, like in the path of practice.
Yeah.
It gets loosened up, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My first understanding of this storehouse consciousness was that it was not kind of an individual, like that it was all the seeds of every arising.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like how I get confused thinking about the karmic part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, is there any storehouse consciousness that's not, are there any of these hypothetical seeds that are not arising through a sentient being?
No. They're all storehouse consciousness. It is only in sentient beings, and vice versa. All sentient beings mm-hmm. have storehouse consciousness.
So that makes a big line between sentient.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, we were talking about this teaching of the insentient thing a little bit, but maybe let's not get into that right now. But, okay, another story here, too. You said what gives rise to them? Or I'm not sure. This might be a little bit more about your question, is that they're individual, every sentient being, again, this is a model, so it's not some thing, but I think in terms of talking about it, it's good to think that everyone has their unique karmic stream, unique continuum of karmic dispositions. We know that, we sense that's true, and yet we're very interconnected too. So all these alliances are kind of like overlapping, and they affect each other.
Yeah.
And the way that they affect each other in the way, but this is where it gets so hard to talk about, because it's like the way that what you're saying is affecting me right now is actually, you're my creation of you, you know, like right. The whole way that you're affecting me is my dispositions for how I even understand you. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's always, we're like, in a way, it's like this feeling of being trapped in this like encapsulated person. That's the suffering, actually. Mm-hmm. Feeling like that we can't get out of our own version of things except through this practice. But here's a story, too, about an experience. Let's say, let's talk about a cookie. Cookie's nice because we sit down to eat. There's a plate with a cookie. We have a whole bunch of senses operating. We see it, and we smell it, and we're about to taste it, and we can touch it. Even like a baby starts learning in this way, right? And as the sutra says, there can be multiple sense consciousnesses operating with the same mental consciousness, with one mental consciousness. So it's like there's a mental experience that's constantly changing. It's a cookie, it's a thing, and it's out there, and like it smells good. It's like all these, you know, a million moments of thought about in each like second, probably, right, of like all the thoughts we have about it. And so pick it up, then we taste it, and meanwhile the mental consciousness is operating, and it's calling it a cookie. We think of it as a cookie. This is the one that ascribes names. The sixth consciousness is the one that ascribes names to objects. That's one of its jobs. And it's aware of it, and it also, along with mental consciousness, comes all these mental factors. So like there's like 51 or different systems of mental factors, like say greed and hate and mind. Yeah, the samskaras go along with the six. They go along with it, and yet they're stored in here, like everything is. Because in fact, samskara, I think that my sense is that this is kind of an evolution from the samskara skanda. In the five skanda system, you have consciousness, But the fourth skanda is called samskara. It's called karmic formations. And it's this huge system that it includes all these mental factors, and they're karmically conditioned mental factors, and they're all are like habitual tendencies is another translation for the fourth skanda. So in a way, I think that what they did is they said, we're going to say all of this is consciousness, we're going to put everything into the consciousness skanda in this mind-only system, because wouldn't that be neat? So let's call the samskara skanda, let's like actually rename it alaya vijnana and give it some other jobs too. I think it's very related to the fourth skanda. But as Vasubandhu says in the 30 verses, he lists all these mental faculties, and he says, he connects it all with the six. He says, the six consciousness comes with like attention and mindfulness and so on, which is why this is what's used for meditation. And it comes with like the feeling of pleasure as we're eating the cookie. So then this whole thing, each bite, each moment is getting each moment of experience is getting planted in here. So then we have this whole associated thing. It's completely complex, right? That now we have this association of like a cookie, it smells and tastes. I see it in the distance, but now it's like associated with this taste and smell and the pleasant feeling. And that whole thing is planted in here. So now the next time we see just a picture of a cookie on the television screen, right, we immediately start salivating. So it's kind of an explanation for that. You could also, this is memory. This stores memory. And that's part of the reason why it was, why they came up with this storehouse, because there's some questions that are unresolved if we don't have a storehouse consciousness. And there are ways to resolve them because there's other schools that don't have them. But it nicely resolves questions such as, what happens, so during the day when we're awake, all this stuff is operating. Mental consciousness always has an object. Even when we're meditating, there's always this object. But what about deep sleep? No. Dreaming, you could say dreaming is still like is mental objects. But what about deep dreamless sleep that happens to every person every night? They would even say without this, the person would just die, actually. How could there be? Because you need an object a mental object for the mental consciousness to continue, and you need a previous moment. For the next moment of consciousness to arise. So if you stop mental consciousness in deep sleep, how could it ever start again?
Is it only non-nervous system? Is it like it has consciousness to keep on functioning?
Well, we could maybe connect autonomic nervous system with this alaya thing in the story, because also this, as the sutra will say, it connects to the body.
To me, it does.
But since this is all a non-physical story, it's all a mind story, it doesn't go there. But the world is mind. That's why, yeah, mind, person, and world are like equal.
So it seems to me that just as we have the habitual tendency to be born with two arms, two legs, mm-hmm. that we also are born with propensity. Mm. Some individuals will be born with propensity to become amazing musicians at age 7, and others fantastic drawers and artists because they have these karmic propensities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you could maybe explain that the thing about that your autonomic nervous system, we have seeds for that would wake you up, that would activate a mental consciousness, you know, out of a deep sleep or out of a coma. They say all this alaya is still operating in a coma, but if you don't have, you could be in a coma for years. And in this system, no problem, because alaya is just a lot. It's like your life energy still storing all this stuff. When you wake up, you're still going to have it. But if you don't have that, it might be problems.
Well, here in a sleep state where you're not dreaming, there's still body consciousness that in signaling, like your lungs are signaling, you're talking to your heart, saying you need more oxygen. Mm.
I don't think that would be called body consciousness.
No.
I think the fact that when we roll over in our sleep, but we don't know that we rolled over, I think that might be bodily consciousness, because it's. But I think our autonomic nervous system, like breathing and heartbeat, is maybe connected with alaya, but I don't think it's body consciousness.
I think even the design of the person breathing is connected to alaya consciousness. The DNA, that information, it gets reduced into a smaller and smaller structure, still there's no structure left.
Maybe. I mean, these are modern science stories about DNA.
No, also, like, in regard to her question about what happens to an enlightened being, I read this sutra one time, and Buddha was talking about, I think what goes on is things are retracted, and, okay, the sensory world shuts down, you go through a phase where, like, say the archetypal forms, like we have visions of gods, and then a goat or something like that, and then start seeing basic forms themselves and hearing sounds. You might see matrices and things that would be hearing sounds in space. I think it kind of retracts into that until you finally go blank, and then the consciousness, because of the propensity of things to come into consciousness again, and then these same things that were retracted begin to express themselves, and depending upon the environment, is somewhat.
Yeah, I mean, talking this when we get into Buddhas and stuff, it's like so far, it's so speculative. I mean, it's nice to hear how the system deals with it, but it's. Yeah, so that kind of, I want to try to avoid like metaphysical stuff and completely outside our experience stuff, because I think this is about our experience, and to like try to keep it mostly anyway about like how we work, can we work with this?
She asked that question, and also in reference to yours, I think that if you look at the seeds, and also the seed gives birth, to a root and to the leaves. So these two things are developing at the same time. You were mentioning something about that earlier.
I think the seed thing is more about that it's a nice metaphor, because you can plant it and it gives later it gives rise to something else, and then the plant grows new seeds and those fall down back into the ground.
Seeds, like, they can be events that happen. Like, you're talking about maybe seeing two things happen at the same time. I was thinking that maybe a lot of these experiences are polysensory or synesthetic, and this is what gets. This is, could be a seed that is imprinted. And say this was a painful experience or it was a joyous experience. And somebody says one word, and all of a sudden all the memories come alive. I mean, they poke you in an emotionally deep place, and all of a sudden you're bitter or something like that.
Yeah, all this stuff is because of alaya.
Yeah. And so those kinds of seeds.
Mm-hmm. Nice link to this storehouse is that in the 12-fold chain of causation, they say ignorance is a condition for karmic formations, samskara, skanda, which is a condition for consciousness, which is kind of funny in the 12-fold chain, right? But it works very nicely with this. That's one of the things they say, is that this explains those two links in the early system of 12-fold chain of causation. Karmic formations are a condition for consciousness, and so in a way they dependently co-arise. Karmic formations and the storehouse consciousness, we could almost say they're the same thing, but officially they say they dependently co-arise. Did you? Okay. How about? What you haven't asked yet. Yeah. We have seeds for desire for certain things due to karmic dispositions, and it's individual for different people, different sentient beings. And so practice, you could say practice with our, the kind of like a conscious practice, like mind training when we're doing compassion practices and stuff. It's basically we're training alaya, which is, that's, you can make it more and more karmically positive. That's still not liberation, but it is essential. And actually, both good karma seeds and also wisdom seeds, because that's how this whole thing is going to get like overturned in the end, is that like we have these seeds, and this is an interesting thing, I think, that they're called seeds for hearing Dharma. And they're like, and all sentient beings have these, which is kind of connected to the Buddha nature idea. And so even though it's almost all delusion and dualistic karmic seeds, there's also these seeds, and they get watered. So Thich Nhat Hanh's image for this kind of thing, right? You're watering seeds. Mm-hmm. Water your good seeds. And so this kind of class, right, we're watering these wisdom seeds that are actually changing subtly and gradually our experience. It's kind of an amazing thing. That'll eventually, like, through just words and then understanding them, eventually, like, you know, all the words dissolve and everything. Did Rich, you had a...
Yeah, I'm going back. I know this is the mind-only school, so I'm not wanting to appear against, but I'm being caught up myself in the idea that there is a phenomenon so if all the colors, sounds, smells, tastes, and touches are mind only, and there isn't a phenomenal world, that mind is
interacting with.
And I know separating things into mind and phenomenal world is a dualistic concept, but this is all conventional reality we're talking about here, not alternate anyway. How would all these particular minds, billions of particular minds, billions of sentient beings, if you count all the animal kingdom, how are we all experiencing, somehow doing this dance with a phenomenal world that doesn't exist except in all these individual
beings? Yeah, that's one of the common questions. I think I did mention last time, but it's kind of, this is, I think, an important point, because this is one of our biggest doubts that comes up around this whole thing. And it's explained as first of all, they say, we don't actually experience them quite the same, and that's why the classic metaphor of the fish relating to water differently than people. And I think to think even that simple story, it's good to actually contemplate again and again really deeply this thing about the fish, because it's very simple, but it's really profound. To kind of imagine being a fish and seeing water, you really don't experience the same objective thing as a person.
But it lives in the water, and the water supports it.
Yeah, so...
It's
so,
there, but the, know it.
Uh-huh.
It is there.
But the water is... it's not that there's nothing. I think that's an important point. It's not that there's nothing. But the water...
doesn't even know it's there. So how...
What's that?
It'd be there for the fish to swim through.
It's relating... I mean, it has an alaya, and it's creating in a different way than people, according to the story. It looks like animals do relate to an external world. And I think, you know, fish might not think about water just like we don't think about air. But we're relating to it. They relate to it, but in a completely different way. So I think that's a good example. And you could say, but still, there's some similarity between fish and us in relation to water, and definitely amongst all of us. I think this is your question. Why do we see water the same way? And I think it's also good to remember that it's definitely never the same way. You put a glass of water here, and we all see it from a different angle. And we actually think of water a little bit differently. And you could say, well, that's not really what it's about. But yeah, that is what it's about. I think it's really important to...
Our own friendship, our particular concepts of the thing we're talking about,
yeah,
is slightly different.
But you're
the phenomenal world that we're interacting with...
You're saying that there really is a basis for the concept.
So we would see it close enough to where we could talk about it as being one.
Yeah, the reason why we see it similarly enough, according to the system, the seeds. We have, as human beings, we share similar types of seeds. We have similar karmic dispositions. Living in America, we have different karmic seeds than people living in Africa, actually.
Well, the different seeds actually explain how we could see them slightly differently.
Exactly.
But they don't explain how we could all see the same thing.
But we don't see exactly the same. We see similar.
Right?
Enough to look at it with electron microscopes in two different places and say it's the same thing.
Yeah. That's can we call it very similar? Very, very similar. Even two people looking at the same microscope, they're gonna, because of their karmic dispositions, they're gonna, one's gonna say, one's colorblind.
One's gonna say it's CO2, and the other one's gonna say it's CO2. They're gonna say it's CO2.
No, because they have different languages, so.
They might not say it's CO2. I might look at it and see energetic vibration.
Exactly, you have to be a scientist to know,
exactly. So
chemist to know CO2.
This is a conceptual explanation of an assumption put into words so that people can agree on what the world is according to this explanation instead of a scientist's explanation.
Yeah, yeah. So that's an example.
Right. So if you define the world as being mind-only and then explain, come up with a system so that it works, have you really proven it's mind-only? You changed the definition of mind to encompass everything, including the phenomenal world, rather than the mind that we normally assume in our dualistic way is simply what works with the phenomenal world in a cause and effect relationship. So it's a tautology, as all.
It is a system. It's an imagination of how things could be, but. But it has answers for these questions, and so it's not saying. That's why I didn't put up at the top a map of reality, because I think that's going too far. It's more. And I have a friend who's really says, don't ever call these things like models of reality, because they're meditation tools. Is what they are, actually.
Yeah, I think I can address some of what we're just talking about.
Okay.
If a neuroscientist, a cognitive scientist, and a quantum mechanics person would be in the room listening to this, they would say, well, what you're talking about is probability distribution. That our habitual natures is just that we have, through our karmic activity, increased the possibility we'll experience that same thing again.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, we all have the same probability distribution.
Very, very similar.
So you all have. But
I think we should be. This is crucial.
Say that what you're really
same
looking at
and
when
similar.
You see something is the instrument you're seeing with. That you can't be certain of where anything is, and that depending upon the instrument, a different reality arises. But we all have similar instruments in this regard. So what this is here is not a map of the mind per se, or reality per se. It's a heuristic device by which we can look at the mind. It is a kind of lens which accounts for an awful lot. Most of what we could possibly see is accounted for here. So it's a heuristic device, actually. And I think in this sense, then, if we're all looking through this particular lens, we will all see similar things. We could also do it through neuroscience or through quantum mechanics or anything like that. This is amazingly sophisticated for something that was 2,000 years old.
And I think it is good to ask, to explore these kinds of questions, because if we have... If big things start to break down in the system, like it couldn't work, and it's just like a kind of like a sort of like weakly constructed system, we won't be able to really get into it. And I think the idea as a meditation device is you have to really get into it. You have to like try it on like 100% through your imagination, actually. But if we have, so it's like getting really wholeheartedly into this imagined thing. And the reason why they have like all these thousands of pages describing the system is like all these doubts we have. Like I'll try to get wholeheartedly into it, but like actually it's ridiculous.
To explain one question gets popped up when the chapter gets written.
Yeah, yeah. To the point where like I mean I personally have the experience like as an intellectual exercise, it really starts to convince my intellect, because I've asked all those questions, and it's got all these answers, and it's shifting the intellect in a way that's very uncanny and uncomfortable, because it's like, it's, and in fact, just today I was listening to this talk by Bertrand Russell, who was talking about idealism, and I was like, this is exactly the same thing. He's talking about a table, and he's saying, like, we all see it actually differently. We can never see it the same, even though we see it similarly. And therefore, if you really, like, draw out the implications and look at this, we can't actually prove that there's an external world. We can't actually prove that there's a table. But then at the end, because he's a philosopher, he's just like, and it can, like, be a very strange and kind of like shaking experience to see that. But, you know, this is just philosophy. Whereas this is it's not just meant to be kind of a little trip to go on. It's more like this is this liberative. I think we should remember that part.
Bertrand Russell would put his teacup on the table.
Yeah.
That he can't
prove
it was there. And one thing you said about conditioning or training a storehouse consciousness, if just, you know, like I can understand this in terms of this probability distribution. When I'm in meditation, when I'm in practice, and I have a very fixed idea and a very fixed feeling associated with that, and that is real, and as I relax that, I'm actually reducing the probability. And so ultimately, I think what happens is there's no probabilities. Everything is equally possible. I think that's the mirror mind. But the act of practicing, I think, can be an act of actually touching all that's in Alaya and just opening up our perspective on everything that exists instead of just running down the same probabilistic ruts. Does that make any sense?
And another thing is, like, I think the question that keeps, one of the ones that keeps being like a sticking point for me in various different angles, it keeps like, you know, rearing its head from different sides, is this thing of like, well, we're talking about our experience, so our experience, and the whole way we can ever experience the world is through our experience, through these consciousnesses, and that's a lot easier to grok, I think, to actually accept. And we say, but what's outside the experience? What's the basis of these illusory images that our mind is projecting? There must be some objective basis. And, like, you know, what is that? What's behind it? And that kind of question, something like that, keeps coming up. And it doesn't deal with this issue. This system doesn't. It's like it doesn't matter, actually. And it tends, like, my mind keeps going to, like, well, it should matter. I guess it's like the doubting mind that wants to clarify that part. But if you also call it, that it's Alaya, there's nothing outside of Alaya. It's based on other subtler, inconceivable aspects of Alaya, if we say it like that, that Alaya is inconceivable. There's no way to access whether there is a basis for the, you know, mental imputation of table or floor. It's saying that if there was some basis, it couldn't be. We could never relate to it.
From this basis, there can't be a physical object that we're separate from that we're actually seeing and knocking on, which makes it easier to understand the impermanence of this.
Yeah, what we're actually seeing and knocking on is not the actual object.
It's just
that's
a manifestation that we're sharing.
It's a mental construct. Yeah,
yeah, it's a rendition. Right. It's a rendition of something.
Mm-hmm.
Just aware Sally has been raising her hand and hasn't been acknowledged.
So kind, thank you.
Well, I think it's part of our process as a group that we should be aware that some of us are strong, like we jump in.
Well,
and
thank
others.
You. You can see that. I couldn't see Sally.
Yeah.
Sally.
So just to be sensitive to that, I just
and point it out to me if I don't see someone.
Yeah,
please.
That's
so thank you.
Right,
so let's have this be the last one because
so
it's
is
time.
There any time. Because it's kind of, I could just say it and then we can talk about it next time.
Okay.
Because I was very interested last time when you were talking about a now moment. Versus direct experience. I think you were saying that it's somehow different.
A now moment?
A now moment. That when Jean asked this question last week, he was talking about direct experience, and you said in this model it talks about a now moment that's somehow different than that.
A now moment. Can't remember what I said then. But we did talk about direct yeah. perception and direct experience.
All right.
Huh.
You'll have to listen to your tape.
From yeah. That. See. Mm.
Okay, so that's a little bit more of the system. Maybe we finish this chapter next time. And just as a meditation practice, besides this glass of water thing, I think really simple things that are really, really mind-shaking for me are the glass of water thing and this dream image that's always used in the school of when you're actually in a dream, there's a really apparent external world in the dream. It really seems external to the mind, but we know it's obviously created by the mind. So, and that's just, that we know that that's possible, right? So therefore, to expand that into like, well, if that's possible, then what if the same thing is kind of happening when we're awake? A little different because there's something more dynamic with the external. There's something more shared. I think that's what it is. We're sharing more when we're not in the dream because we share through our sensory organs, and in the dream, we go inward. Yeah. May all beings open to all as mine. Beings are numberless. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable.